This is the Banana Data Podcast, a podcast hosted by Data IQ. I'm Trevaini.
And I'm Chris.
And in our bi-weekly episodes, we'll discuss the good, the great, and the ugly of AI. If you're craving even more, check out our 15-minute Banana Bites discussions on Data IQ's LinkedIn and Twitter every Wednesday at 2 p.m. EST. On today's episode, we're speaking to Oscar Waltinez, engineer at Google and board member at FinMango, about his work on the COVID Monitor Project, the value of data transparency and access for all. Hi, Oscar. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, Oscar, before we dig into it, can you tell us a little bit about what is the COVID Monitor Project and what's your role in it?
The COVID Monitor is a joint venture between FinMango and Florida COVID Action. And the main goal was to, or still is, to track data around schools and the school reopening. And I'm not talking just about epidemiological data, number of cases and so forth, but also things like how many students are actually going physically into the schools, how many students are online only, how many schools are doing some kind of hybrid model. The main goal of the COVID Monitor is to track all that across all of the school districts in the U.S., which are 13,000 of them. And my role within the project, as part of FinMango, I am the technical advisor.
It seems like this type of endeavor is going to work pretty well if we have power in numbers with these various different avenues of individuals possibly crowdsourcing for self-reporting. What was one of the challenges to getting the word out there to help individuals feel like they're contributing to this greater good? And how did you overcome that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we initially tried to solve this problem in the most automatic way possible. Very quickly, we hit a wall there. In many cases, because the reporting is simply not there, non-existent. So we have to rely exclusively on self-reported data. In many other cases, the data is published in ways that is just very difficult to handle automatically or electronically. Sometimes you have like a PDF file and the format changes every day. So might as well, you probably spend less time if you copy the numbers manually as opposed to trying to figure out some kind of automatic solution. So it was very crucial as part of this project to make sure that we had enough people that could help this crowdsource effort. We tried to do a couple of calls for volunteers that had mixed results. The quality of the volunteers was very variable. A lot of people are very, very eager to start. And then when they realize it's very grinding work, and in many cases, you spend more time looking for the numbers than actually copying the numbers, many people just fall off. So fortunately, we had the help from FinMango, which has a huge pipeline of volunteers, and they put a lot of their efforts into this project. So they diverted from a lot of different projects they were working on, all those volunteers, and they moved them onto this project. And that's how we were able to get things off the ground very quickly. We're still in the process of trying to recruit more volunteers, and we're trying to get people from different backgrounds because right now it's very one-sided. We have all the people that are as part of FinMango, but obviously that's people with a specific background. So we just want a little more diverse set of volunteers, and we're still looking for that. We're still trying to get the word out. So that's still a challenge.
Yeah, so it sounds like this is a pure data problem, not in the fact that the data doesn't exist, but that it exists in all these multiple forms, and you guys are trying to figure out the best way forward. And something you said about it will be faster to just manually enter the numbers, that, you know, I think that resonates with a lot of people in the data science space, especially when you're dealing with this kind of really messy, unstructured stuff that changes day to day. Chris and I have had previous conversations about, well, you know, sometimes it's just faster to do it the raw manual way than it is to do this custom code. So I think what you're saying really resonates there.
The other part is that by reporting more and more data, even when the data is not easily accessible, we're actually adding pressure for others to report that data. And that's also been a crucial part of this process, having that public pressure that has directly led to entire states reporting data for schools, which we believe would have not happened if it wasn't for the public pressure in large part coming from our project.
That's fantastic. Are these states reporting it in a way now that's easily accessible for you or easy to understand and digest, or is it still this sort of mishmash?
They have certainly improved. And in many cases, we make the case of having accessibility issues. EBS in general can work okay, but say that you are in a state that you have thousands of school districts, which can be the case in multiple states. Having big cable just doesn't cut it. Imagine you have something like a screen reader and you have to swipe through hundreds, if not thousands, of districts until you get to the one you actually are interested in. So it's not just for us to be able to consume this data, but it's about making the data more accessible for everyone.
So you actually mentioned a little bit ago that you're getting all this data from various different sources. You know, on the podcast, we often talk about that it's not only the volume of the data you get, but the reliability of that data. And sometimes the reliability and credibility of that data matters even more so. So how were you able to uniformly gather that data such that you can use it in the most constructive way possible?
First, what we do is we separate what are the self-reported data with the data that is reported by the actual authority. The main reason being that the self-reported data is going to be, by definition, a subset of the entire data. You're never going to get a complete or comprehensive view only from self-reported data. The other side of the coin is that the data that is reported by the authority, can we trust it? This has been an extremely politicized problem, data around COVID-19. And in many cases, the person that you should be able to trust, the person that is providing this data for you, may have not necessarily an agenda, but may have an idea of how this data should be interpreted. And in doing so, sometimes they filter it, sometimes they present it in a way that makes it harder to understand or harder to consume. So all those things are the data brokers in a way, which then affects everyone downstream as a data consumers. So we have to keep all those things in mind. And as I said, first we separate what is the self-reported data with the authority, the data from the authority. And then we just try to be as objective as we can with the data. We transparency is key for us.
Yeah, I think that's a problem across all data sets in terms of the validity and how do we confirm that this is actually reliable, but especially as you're saying, in the situation of COVID-19, where it is highly politicized. And so you're not sure what data you should trust. And you mentioned this issue of data transparency, which I think is really critical. I'm curious to know, how does this work fit into your view on data transparency and access to relatively important data sets that might also be highly political, highly sensitive, what have you?
Data transparency, I believe, is multidimensional. It's not just about having the data available, but you need to do a number of things to make sure that you have a truly transparent data set. First, you need to make very, very clear where your data is coming from. In some cases, you can only disclose the source. In some cases, you have to mask that in a way that, you know, to preserve privacy. We are talking about self-reported data. You can't mention people by name or say specific schools, right? We agree by a school district because when you are talking about very small schools, sometimes that's sufficient to identify an individual. So we have to be very careful about that. But once you overcome the problem of privacy by aggregation, you also have to take care of the processing of the data. In many cases, you have projects that very much disclose how the data was sourced, and then they have data that you can use, but they are a black box in the way that they process that data. And this is not necessarily an issue of trust, but everyone makes mistakes. You could have issues, you could have bugs in the code that you use to process that data, even if it's just throwaway code that many data scientists typically use. But that is still important to publish, to make sure that others can double check your work and can make sure that, you know, from beginning to end, they can have fully reproducible results. So that's one key tenet for us. And that's why all the code that we use for our data sets, it is fully open source. And you should start with the same inputs, use our very same code, and you should run the exact same outputs that we publish.
I think that's a really interesting part of this, the reproducibility of a public data set like this. So often we take it at face value that the WHO put out this data set or so-and-so gave us this data. That must mean it's true. So I really appreciate you guys sharing your code and being able to share your process. How do you guys work around the question of data literacy, right? Because you're sending this data, or this data is available for really anyone to pick up and use for whatever purpose they want. What mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that folks are understanding what this data is actually providing and not providing?
So let me see. I think there's different parts to the answer to this question. I think data in itself, and this is what I'm going to say, is quite controversial. Data in itself is useless. What is important is how the data comes across. And for that, you need some way to display this data. Generally, it's about data visualization, although that doesn't sound like a very inclusive term, but that's what the industry uses, unfortunately. So let's call it that for now. Data visualization is also not a one-size-fits-all. And this is something that I think our practice still does not do a sufficiently good job. We have a map, and we have a dynamic report for each of the school districts. But I believe that we still need to publish different data visualizations for different, I don't want to call it levels, but for different needs that people have. In some cases, you may just want to see a single number, how many cases there are in my school district and the three or four nearby me, and that's completely fine. In some cases, you may want to see some kind of bar chart or a line chart that shows the historical progression of those cases. And repeat this by a number of times until you have covered as many of those use cases as possible. And I think we still need to cover a lot more use cases. So to answer your question more concretely, the way we tackle this, or the way we hope to tackle this, is by having a big breadth of different visualizations and different ways to present this data, because we don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach.
So it sounds like with the use of the data in this fashion, there's going to be a lot of immediate impact of the work just by virtue of answering a lot of these questions with various visualizations and so on and so forth. But how do you feel like this is also going to impact the future for long-term impact, where the availability of this data and the code and everything else is going to impact future endeavors?
I think on one side, we are educating people into making data-driven decisions, making informed decisions. And I think that's something that we, as data scientists, this crowd takes for granted, but a lot of people don't have that mindset. So I think that one very positive thing that has come out of this is that people now put a lot of weight and a lot of importance into looking at numbers and looking at data and making decisions based on that. And I think that's super, super important. So at the very least, I think in the long term, that's going to change, or that has changed, obviously not for everyone, but for, in my opinion, a lot of people. Then at the same time, as we continue to aggregate data, because this is not a weekend project, this is an ongoing thing. And every week there are new schools that are opening, new schools that go from hybrid to in-person only or the other way around, and the data continues to change. So we're going to continue to aggregate more and more data, and we'll be able to derive, or we'll be able to figure out more of these correlations that are currently hidden, because we, at the moment, I don't think we have enough data to be able to have a very clear picture of how schools reopening are affecting the pandemic. Even though we've already seen some early studies and some people are already making their own conclusions, I believe we still need a lot more data to be able to make a fully informed decision.
Yeah, related to this, you know, where people are making their own conclusions with whatever data is available, do you guys have any visibility into who's using the data? How is it getting used? What are the broader pieces of effect that you guys are having right now? And I ask because you said, you know, quite nicely that data itself is useless. It's how you actually visualize or analyze it. And that's where all of our ability to bias and skew things comes in. So have you guys confronted someone using this data maybe to present a case or a version of the situation that's not quite aligned with how you see the situation?
So that's actually something that we are dealing with almost on a daily basis. And we have seen most of the uses of the data around schools. In some cases, they are citing the data that we have gathered directly. They are going into conclusions that we don't necessarily agree, or that we don't think that data supports. So as you say, the interpretation part is where we can actually excuse. You can massage the numbers and you can make him tell you whatever you want, right? If you massage him for long enough. So that's something that we're still struggling with. And this is particularly sensitive because we are talking about something that affects the health of a lot of people. So it is something that we don't take lightly. And we try to strike a balance between, obviously, we want to make the data available for everyone, and we don't want to limit what people can do with this data. We want to make sure this data is as universally useful as possible. But at the same time, we want people to be responsible with this data. So we want to support good science. We want to support good use of this data. And we have seen so far a mixed bag.
On the note of the mixed bag reactions, Oscar, can you tell us one positive outcome and maybe also one negative outcome that was unforeseen?
Positive outcome, I think that people are just looking at the data. And that to me is a huge win, because before we were flying blind. So to me, the fact that people are looking at this data to make their decisions, and I'm not talking just about scientists or the policymakers, I'm talking about parents and the people that are sending their kids to school. And they're looking at this data and they're using it to inform their day-to-day decisions. I love that. I think that's fantastic. So to me, that's been a huge positive. And I think that's going to have a long-lasting impact, because that's a way of thinking. You don't just suddenly turn into a data scientist, but you slowly go into a way of thinking that is around information. It's about data-driven decisions. So I think that's something that is hard to take away once you have discovered that. And then the negative part will be what I believe is irresponsible use of this data. It is jumping to conclusions. It is people who believe that, you know, you look at two dots and you can draw a line and then you can do an interpolation and then you have it all figured out. That's not how this works. I don't think we have enough data yet to be able to actually make an assessment about how this is going to play out. We are still learning on a daily basis, learning from how things are going.
I think that's fascinating to see, at least on the positive side, people learning to use data to make better decisions for themselves. But then, of course, the negative impact is pretty much the same, where they're using the data to make a conclusion that might not actually be the best. Those are some interesting ends of almost the same spectrum. So moving forward, what do you see the future of this project, or maybe projects like this in the future looking like? I hope that COVID-19 is our last pandemic ever, but there probably will be future health crises. That's just life. So do you see this work moving forward in a way that could be useful and repeatable, maybe even automated in the future?
First, let me tell you what I wish would happen, and then I'll tell you what I think is actually going to happen. What I wish would happen is that projects like this one are completely unnecessary, because we have the relevant health authorities be much more transparent and much more upfront about this data. Let me see if I can phrase this in an uncontroversial way, but I truly believe that in some cases, we are being treated like children. We're being treated like we are not worthy, or cannot be trusted with this data, the raw data, not necessarily the raw data, but the full data. So they give us a little slice, or they give us a little report, or they withhold reports. I think that that's one thing that we can definitely improve on. And I think that that's not going to happen overnight. As data scientists, we request this data. We need to call for it. It's not going to be given to us. So we need to add that pressure. So that's what I wish will happen. What I think is actually going to happen is that this project will continue to gather data and will continue to make it universally accessible and useful as long as it's relevant, as long as we still don't understand how this works and how this is affecting schools and kids and families. Once we have a better understanding because of much better and a lot more data, then this project just becomes less useful, less impactful. So I think that, you know, once that happens, we'll slowly, probably reduce the number of volunteers, we'll reduce the frequency in which we are updating the data, and then eventually it will go away. But that's not going to happen until we think, or we'll continue to keep this project alive for as long as we think it is useful and relevant.
So on that point, how do you recommend that we best contribute to this moving forward? I imagine that you have some advice for what is the best mechanism by which people can help out in this endeavor, not only as just a layperson, but also as, you know, the data scientists who may be helping with this analysis.
So I think it's very, very important for us not to be complacent. And I think that as a data scientist, I've been very guilty of this myself. You just sit back and you look for what data is available, and then you just work with what you have. And that doesn't cut it here. The problem that we're having here is that we need to continue to add pressure for the data to be available. In some cases, it's a matter of resources. Many of these health authorities, they have enough to deal with. I mean, we're in a pandemic. One of the last things they have to worry about is to make the data scientists happy, right? But I think that's very short-sighted. And I think we need to continue to add pressure for the data to be publicly available and to be released on a timely manner. And I think that that's not going to happen, again, if we just sit back and wait for it to be given, that we need to ask for it and we need to add pressure. And that applies to both the layperson and to the data science community.
That's fantastic. Oscar, this has been a really great conversation. I've certainly learned a lot. And I think for the listeners out there who might actually be interested in helping the COVID Monitor project, how can they get in touch or volunteer? Do they need to go through FinMango or is there a website?
Yes. So there are two websites you can check out. First is, of course, the COVID Monitor website is thecovidmonitor.com. And then we also have the volunteer form on the FinMango website, and that will be under finmango.com/COVID.
Great. We will link to those in the show notes as well. Well, thanks again, Oscar, for your time. And thank you for your work on the COVID Monitor project.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys giving me the time to speak about this.
Once again, a big thank you to Oscar and all those contributing over at FinMango to the COVID Monitor project. If you're interested in contributing, check out the links in the show notes below. That's all we've got today in the world of banana data. We'll be back with another podcast in 2 weeks. But subscribe to the Banana Data newsletter to read these articles and more like them. And we've got links for all the articles we discussed today in the show notes below. Until next time.